we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
The less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Good afternoon and welcome to Animal Voices Radio at CFRO 100.5 Co-op Radio, Vancouver, Canada. I'm Carol Davies McIntosh with Elise Jacobson.
Hello.
And Allison Cole.
Hi there.
It's Friday, June 28th, 2019. On today's show, we're going to hear from Darlene Levesque from the group Nation Rising about the recent rally on Parliament Hill. We'll also hear from a knowledgeable and passionate frog advocate and conservationist, Matt Ellerbeck.
Today's show is sponsored by Edible Planet. Edible Planet is a Vancouver-based education campaign and TV series designed to teach people about the world's most powerful edible plants and the fascinating people who bring them to market. Food is the world's most powerful tool to share the wealth, help chronic illness, regreen the planet, and create lasting world peace today. Now is the time for a plant-based economy, because on this big, beautiful, edible planet, the food we eat can change the world.
And now, Allison has a few words to say about the recent bear killing in the Vancouver area. Conservation? I think not.
Well, yes. So we often hear in the Lower Mainland seeing the news that yet another bear or another cougar was shot because they encroached a little bit too closely within the human population. And of course, it's really us who are living on their environment, right? So mm-hmm. earlier this mm-hmm. week on Tuesday, there was a black bear that made some human contact with some picnickers in Burnaby Mountain. And the bear took a swipe at the woman, and they reported this incident to the conservation officers, and they set a trap for this bear. There had apparently been about 100 reports of this bear wandering around last few weeks looking through people's garbage
because
they're hungry. And so what do you imagine is the answer when, say, you're a conservation officer? I would think that would mean an officer to protect wildlife animals. Mm-hmm. What do you do in this situation? As it turns out, you shoot them in the head.
Mm. Right. Well, I mean, and that was some kind of an altercation. I mean, the people were trying to scare the bear away. I don't know exactly what they did to try to scare the bear away, but people can be pretty dumb in those situations. I've seen people do some crazy things with bears in the woods, and they, you know, the bear may be used to people, but they probably incited her.
Yeah, so she was just defending herself, no doubt. Hey.
Oh, well, of course, and that this kind of incident happens so frequently, it seems like, and then there's nothing. It just seems like the answer is to shoot, kill the animal,
mm-hmm.
and even a mother with her babies, as was done in the past. I don't know if that was this year or last year, but yeah. So I just feel like, you know, we here at Animal Voices, we feel that we share the earth with all living beings, and we have to learn how to share that responsibility and being responsible to ourselves and keeping us as humans safe, but also keeping the animals safe as well, especially the wildlife. Everyone loves wildlife. And well, I think there's been a lot in social media going up against this action, and a lot of people that might not usually identify as, you know, animal advocates are speaking up and saying this was wrong.
Well, and, you know, we're building into the bear's territory. The bears were there first, mm-hmm. and we build into their territory. And often you hear people up in Belcarra, which is in Port Moody area, complain about the bears there. Well, it's woods. Mm-hmm. They're living in the forest,
yeah.
and then they complain that there's a bear. If you don't want to be around bears, you know, probably downtown Vancouver is a good place.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and you can't really begrudge them trying to find food when we've, you know, encroached on their territory so much and, you know, wiped out a lot of the areas where they would search for food. You know, they have to, it kind of forces them to come into people's yards and get their garbage and that kind of thing. So.
Exactly.
Right. So the Conservation Officer Service has actually said that it gets an average of 800 bear calls in Burnaby every year.
Wow.
And that's where this Burnaby Mountain is areas, of course. Right. So mm-hmm. it's like urban versus the wild. It's sort of like that crossroads right mm-hmm. there. And that they've had to, it says that they've had to put down an estimated 15 bears already this year in 2019. I don't know about the have to, like, why can't there be other options? So I looked into what the other options could be, because we're trying to find something that's plausible, not mm-hmm. just like a dream fantasy, right? Mm-hmm. And I come from a small town on Vancouver North Island, and bears were everywhere. We used to have a bear come into our patio sometimes, and as I was telling you before, you know, citizens should be taught on how to keep their food away from, exactly. because they're coming for food. And Carol, you were saying something about that people need to be educated on, there's rules, like you can't put your food, your garbage out.
Well, I live in Coquitlam, and we're not allowed to put our garbage out until the morning that garbage is right. being collected, so by 7 o'clock.
The bears do come at night.
They come at night. People used to put their garbage out on my street at night, and they got little notices on their garbage can saying, don't do that, next time it'll be a fine. So, you know, maybe the fine system is the way to go with this.
Well, something is the way to go, and the fact is that there's nothing being done. So our friends at the Association for Fur-Bearing Animals, otherwise known as the Fur Bear Defenders. Right. My friend Leslie works there. So they have a great petition that you can sign that I've posted on our Facebook page, and it's right there at the top. And it's all you do is you put in your postal code, and it'll send an email to your political representatives to give some 3 steps that they could follow out, which is that conservation officers should be directed to show preventative measures, fines, and other educational roles, and that funding should be made to any municipality to increase these bylaw enforcement activities specifically related to wildlife feeding and attractants. And there's some more on there, but I encourage you go to our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, to find out more about how you can help the black bears and other wildlife in BC.
Thank you, Alison.
And now for the news. The Vancouver Aquarium has agreed to a cetacean ban as part of a new 35-year lease agreement with the Vancouver Park Board. It's also dropping its legal action against the Park Board over lost revenue because of the ban. In 2017, the Vancouver Park Board voted to ban keeping whales and dolphins in captivity at the aquarium. Oceanwise, which is the parent company of the Vancouver Aquarium, followed with a lawsuit against the city, claiming the ban resulted in millions of dollars in lost revenue and constituted a breach of contract. Oceanwise said in an emailed statement that it has agreed to no longer display cetaceans in Stanley Park. I think this is a huge victory for not only for the whales and dolphins, but for those of us who have protested the Vancouver Aquarium many times, the whole Vancouver animal advocacy community. We've been pushing for this for a long time. I guess the Vancouver Aquarium obviously will still be keeping animals in captivity. You know, the fight is mm-hmm. not over.
That's right.
I would love to see them become a genuine, you know, rescue and rehab facility, just, you know, rescue animals that need it and then release them.
And we need that whale sanctuary that's coming
exactly.
up here.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah, but this is definitely a step in the right direction. It's pretty amazing. They'll no longer keep dolphins or whales or porpoises of any kind in the aquarium. And Canada's first ever plant-based nutrition conference has wrapped up in Toronto after selling out to an audience of over 300 people. The Canadian Conference on Plant-Based Nutrition and Health featured an all-star roster of prominent Canadian doctors who use evidence-based education to promote a whole foods plant-based diet as a means of preventing and reversing chronic disease. The event was organized by Dr. Zara Kassam in collaboration with the Canadian Academy of Lifestyle Medicine and Dr. Shireen Kassam, founder and director of Plant-Based Health Professionals UK, a member organization of the True Health Initiative. The conference was aimed at both healthcare and medical professionals and members of the public. Speakers highlighted the role diet plays in some of the top health issues facing North America, including cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, and mental health. Health professionals also busted common myths of a plant-based diet and delved into the far-reaching impact our food choices have on the environment. The keynote speaker was Dr. David Jenkins, professor of nutritional sciences at the University of Toronto, whose research team created the well-known glycemic index, a ranking of foods according to how they affect blood glucose levels. His presentation centered on the link between human health and planetary health. Mm-hmm. Dr. Jenkins presented alongside other medical doctors, registered dietitians, and healthcare professionals well-versed in the latest nutrition science.
conference. If you would like to see some of the talks from this conference that just wrapped up in Toronto, you can watch them at www.plantbasedhealthprofessionals.com. Sounds pretty interesting.
I'm going there right now.
Yeah.
I didn't know that this conference was happening in Canada, but I just wanted to point out that there's still time to register for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine 7th Annual Conference on Nutrition in Medicine in Washington, D.C. So similar.
Yeah.
And you can look at, just check out PCRM.org, and that conference comes up on July 26th and 27th in Washington, D.C.
Awesome. Yeah, it's great to see these happening, just getting, you know, all that information out there.
I'm here with Darlene Levesque of Nation Rising. Darlene is in Ottawa. Welcome to Animal Voices, Darlene.
Thank you very much, Carol. Pleasure to be here.
I'm quite interested in the organization that you've co-founded called Nation Rising. Can you briefly describe what that organization is doing or does?
Sure. So Nation Rising started up in around 2017. The founder is Jenny Henry, and she brought first Ben King on board, and then he in turn brought myself on board because we had similar interests in what was happening in Canada and around the world in terms of the large volume of subsidies that are going to animal agriculture. And so we thought that there was a need for a new type of movement within Canada that would call on the government to stop subsidizing the large or the millions of dollars that is getting to animal ag, and instead shift those subsidies to healthier plant-based foods. This is also more in line with the updated Canada Food Guide, which mm-hmm. was announced earlier this year.
Right. So now, are you all coming from an animal advocacy background?
Well, we actually have three demands. And our background for the three of us is mm-hmm. indeed animal activism. Mm-hmm. However, our focus is on getting farmers able to shift from animal agriculture to plant agriculture because it's better for the environment. It's better for people's health, and of course it's better for the animals. And we believe that it's the government's responsibility to help farmers to make that shift and to use those subsidies that are now going to animal agriculture instead to help the farmers shift. So we have a saying, you know, there's no hate for farmers within Nation Rising. We don't want them to fail. We want them to succeed because we know that they give us food. We just want healthy food for Canadians.
Okay.
And we want it to be accessible as well to everyone. So people in the north, the indigenous, and right now there's a lot of people in the north in the Inuit communities who don't have access to healthy, affordable food.
That's
so that's
right.
Another one of our demands as well.
So can you talk a little bit about some of the subsidies that are given to animal agriculture in Canada?
Sure. The two that really stand out for me is Maple Leaf Foods, which is located in Southern Ontario, and they are actually aggregating a number of chicken slaughterhouses into London, Ontario. And they received funding of a total of $87 million between the provincial and the federal government for a huge slaughterhouse that is going to be built outside of London.
$87 million to Maple Leaf Foods, which is a huge, huge food
company.
Huge company.
Exactly. Yeah. So they have sales in 2018 of $3.5 billion. So you have to, you know, you can't help but think of why does a company that makes $3.5 billion need that kind of funding from our government? They should be able to subsidize this themselves. So
right.
it just absolutely makes no sense.
On June 15th, Nation Rising held a rally at Parliament Hill in Ottawa. Can you tell me what that was? Was it a march and a rally? Or
It was a march and a rally. It's our second one. Our first one was last July, and this is our second one in for 2019. We started off with a march from a specific park to the Parliament Hill to gain visibility, of course, within the city, and we had people from all over Canada attend, and then we ended off with a rally on Parliament Hill where we have speakers. So for our speakers, we had an animal activist, Gabriel Nadler, also known as Gaia I, and we also had an 11-year-old youth, Kaya Judge, speak, and her, I don't know if you've had a chance maybe to see her speech, but it was very passionate, very moving. We also had Vicenta Molina, who is an infamous dietitian within Canada, who is still training and speaking worldwide on the benefits of plant-based diet. And we had Renee King-Simon from Texas, who turned their cattle ranch into a farm sanctuary.
I understand that she's working with other ranchers who want to transition to a plant-based
Absolutely.
Farm.
Yeah, it's called the Rancher Advocacy Program. Right now, it's through donations and other supporters that they've been able to get the funding to help the farmers go plant to plant-based crops. Again, they want to have the government take on that responsibility, because if, you know, they're not subsidizing the farmers through animal agriculture, then shift again those subsidies to plants. Why do the citizens of any country have to take on that responsibility? It should be the government helping those farmers to make that change, if that's the direction they want to take.
Is there anyone in Canada? Are there any ranchers in Canada that are doing
that? Yes, there are actually a couple in southern Ontario, but they did convert their farm into a sanctuary, and they are also doing organic crops.
So getting back to the rally now, how many people were in attendance?
We had over 250. Last year, we had closer to 500. We do believe, though, it was primarily due to the inclement weather. We had really, really bad rain that day. And there was also a rally that took place outside of the provincial legislature in Winnipeg. So there's a group of about 60 there. So our intent for, like, the rally here was, you know, very motivating, very uplifting. We saw a large diversity in the people who were attending, from kids to youth to adults to, you know, seniors. I mean, we got really, really good feedback from people that, you know, because of hearing this talk and being motivated to now go out and meet with their MPs. So that's our focus now, is between now and, of course, next year, and especially in light of the election coming up in October, is to get as many meetings as possible with all MPs of any party, in all parties.
Okay. Now, when you held the rally on the Hill, did any of the government officials attend?
Unfortunately not, because it was on a Saturday. Most of the politicians leave to go to their home constituency, and this is also, well, they've closed now.
Right.
They're not sitting any longer. We were fortunate, though, on the 14th, where we held a press conference to get to meet Elizabeth May and talk to her a bit about what we were doing, and so we're hoping to get a meeting into get into more detail with her, especially on the climate environment aspect.
What was Ms. May's take on what you're doing?
More interested in learning more, I would say, because it was, literally a minute or two that we probably had with her. She
right.
was coming from another press conference, but there was definite interest, and we had written to her and asked to have a meeting with her, so we're hoping between now and the election we'll get some time with her.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. And I understand you also spoke briefly with Mr. Suzuki.
Yes, we
David
did.
Suzuki.
Yes. And again, you know, we had to clarify our position that it's no hate for farmers. I mean, we want to support the farmers. We want the government to support the farmers. So it's not about, you know, seeing farmers go broke, bankrupt, you know, and not being able to put food on their own tables. We want the government to help them should they choose, and be encouraged to grow more crops, again, that are in line with our Canada Food Guide.
Okay. So now, okay, so you felt like, you know, maybe the timing was a little bit off. I mean, it's a little, it's difficult if the house isn't sitting and it's an, it, we're coming into an election.
Absolutely. We're leveraging that. And the next thing that we're working on is to get chapters up and running across Canada, because we feel that by having chapters in the major cities, they can help to get more people to go in and meet with their MPs over the next 4 months before the election. We want to make sure that we are being heard, because it will affect people's votes,
right,
for sure.
Okay.
For those who, you know, support Nation Rising and understand what we are standing for and asking for.
So you're looking into more of the one-to-one approach. So people actually going in and talking to their MPs?
Yes. So our call to action is for them to take the time to meet with their MP, making that formal meeting, or when the MPs are going door to door, attend the town hall to make sure that this is heard.
And you have a website, don't you?
Yes, we do. It's nationrising.ca. And we also are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Do you have pamphlets or information that you can provide to people so that they have something to go into their MPs with?
We have a briefing document that they can use to prepare, and then there is a document that they can bring in to their MP, which is a three-pager, which just outlines, you know, why, what we're asking of the leaders, and how they can support us.
Okay,
great. Carol, I do want to thank you for taking the time out to talk about Nation Rising. I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about us in the near future.
Thank you so much, Darlene. I appreciate your time, and we will talk again soon.
Did you know that Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, has over 90 different shows produced by over 350 community members? This wide range of programming produced by our diverse group of programmers ensures that we have a show you'll love. We have shows on feminism, spirituality, disability rights, politics, unions, and parenting. We play jazz, indie rock, reggae, blues, and folk. We broadcast in a dozen different languages and have more First Nations programs than any other radio station in Vancouver. Find your show on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. All different, all the time.
Have some local upcoming events to share. Tomorrow, Saturday, June 29th from 7 a.m. to 11 a.m. at Hallmark Poultry Processors at 1756 Pandora Street. It's the Vancouver Chicken Save Stories Vigil. They say your story is incredible and unique. Please join us in sharing your save stories with the world. Our vigils are focused primarily on the animals and telling their stories to the world. However, none of that would be possible without the activists. We are holding our regular weekly vigil, and while still bearing witness, dedicating the morning to telling the world stories from the activists at the front lines. This is Vancouver Chicken Save's weekly chicken vigil at the Hallmark Chicken Slaughterhouse. We come together to bear witness and say goodbye to the chickens before they go to slaughter. The vigil schedule is 7 to 9 a.m., truck stopping and bearing witness. If you want to go to that, you meet at the northeast corner of Hastings and Salisbury. And then from 9 to 11 a.m. will be outreach and community building. And for that, you meet at the northeast corner of Hastings and Commercial. So again, that's Saturday, June 29th, tomorrow, starting at 7 a.m. And then on Monday, July 1st, from 4 p.m. to 10 p.m. at 400 Industrial Avenue, it's the Day of Giving Within Arbitrary Borders. This was started by local vegans and animal rights activists. Started as a response to Context Devoid Canada Day 150 celebrations that ignore marginalized groups and reinforce oppression, colonialism, and many other stigmatized phobias and judgment-based harms inflicted on our fellow humans. DogWAB, or again, Day of Giving Within Arbitrary Borders, will focus on giving meals, grooming and personal items, socks, and many other useful items to people who should never be without these items for a reason so crass and shameful as not having financial access or socially acceptable
physical presentations of struggle or illness. If you want to learn more or help out, go to Facebook events and search for DogWeb. And on Friday, July 12th, from 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. at Kitsilano Beach, it's the Zero Waste Vegan Beach Potluck and Dance Party organized by the Peace People Project. There will be music by DJ Andrew Pacey. Bring a zero waste vegan dish to share, so no single-use packaging and no animal products. Bring your own bathing suit and towel. Bring your own plates, cup, cloth napkin, silverware, serving utensils, and they say bring your dancey pants. They'll meet on the grassy area near Cornwall and you.
Sounds awesome. I want to go.
Yeah.
As long
like
as
a lot
the
of
weather
fun.
Cooperates.
Are you going to take your dancey pants?
Yeah.
I'm not going to take any pants.
Oh, nice. So again, that's Friday, July 12th, 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. at Kitts Beach, meeting at Cornwall and you. If you have an animal-related event that you'd like us to share on the show, send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com.
You're listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. These are spring peepers and leopard frogs.
Wow.
Sweet. That's the leopard frog.
Earlier, I spoke with Matt Allerbeck, who has run several projects pertaining to the protection of many different species of both amphibians and reptiles. Hi, Matt. Thanks for joining us today on Animal Voices. Matt, you're from Ontario, and you consider yourself a frog advocate and conservationist. Is that right?
Yes.
Check on Google, through Google, says that you are also fascinated with snakes, salamanders, turtles, many other animals.
Yeah, it's just been a lifelong fascination for me. Reptiles and amphibians, and I've done, as you said, like if you look me up on Google, I've done a number of different projects focused on the wide array of different species. So the first one I did with snakes, and then I did some stuff with turtles, and then salamanders, which are amphibians, so it just seemed like a natural progression to do a project with frogs. And I mean, they all kind of complement each other,
right?
Because a lot of the threats that, you know, snakes and turtles face affect frogs and salamanders as well. And when I'm collecting observational records and data for some of the local conservation authorities and other naturalist projects, when I'm in the field in those types of habitats, I often encounter, you know, various species. Like the other day, I was at a lake and I saw some turtles and different frog species, and then the other day some snakes, and then I was up at another spot and there was some newts, which are aquatic salamanders, and then there was many frogs there. So I think it's just an interest of mine, and it's just been a natural progression to just kind of want to give each one a little bit of special focus. But often, even when I do outreach, no matter what, I guess, the focal or flagship species is at the time, there's often references to, you know, those other animals as well, because there are so many similarities in terms of the habitats they utilize and the threats that they face. And I think one really common thing with all reptiles and amphibians is that they're just a generally misunderstood group of animals, and they don't have, you know, as many advocates or allies as a lot of other animals have.
So how many years have you been doing this kind of work?
About 13 years now.
Wow. And what would you say your role in conservation is? Like, I know you go out and you study and you do some counts and that sort of thing, but where does that information go to?
So there's a number of different what are called amphibian and reptile atlas projects that are being run through a number of different organizations. Some are bigger than others, some are more grassroots, but essentially the information being collected And since those various projects are to help sort of identify the number of those species, so are they increasing? Are they declining? Is the population stable? What is their range like? What are their seasonal behaviors? And to identify potential threats to those populations. And then if they're identified, try to lay out some recovery strategies to mitigate those threats. So that's a big part of what I do. And then the other component is just outreach education. So raising awareness, how can the everyday average person get involved with a cause if they don't know there's even an issue? And a lot of people might not be aware of all the problems that amphibians and reptiles are facing, especially salamanders and snakes. A lot of the times can both be quite secretive and spend a lot of time under rocks or logs or in fossorial habitats out of sight. So people don't generally see them, so they might not be thinking about them. So it's important to raise awareness for those animals. So a large part of what I do is going into schools and kids clubs and campgrounds and parks and various other venues and events to let people know that these animals are intrinsically valuable. They play vital roles in the ecosystem that often benefit human beings, but sadly, a lot of them are in decline and in some cases even facing extinction. And then sort of presenting an overview of the threats that are impacting those animals and then letting the average person know what they can do in their day-to-day life to help out, and whether that's habitat management and environmental stewardship, perhaps on their own property, especially for, you know, people who live in rural areas where, you know, they might have ponds or forest or meadows adjacent or on their property. So managing those areas can impact those animals in a really positive way, or inform decision making, or just various things that people can do to help out, and trying to empower people by presenting that information to them.
I want to get back into that in a few minutes, but, you know, I found in doing some research for this interview that I realized how much I have to learn about frogs, and haven't really spent a lot of time. And like you say, they're a little bit secretive. So, you know, I see them when I'm running by in the forest, and I might hear them or see them, you know, sitting on the edge of the bank or something like that of a river, of a stream or a pond. But other than that, I don't have a lot of information about them. So I did a bunch of research and found that I have a lot of questions for you. Or can I fire away?
Absolutely.
Okay. How many species of frogs are there approximately?
There's approximately 5,000 different species. And we say approximately because sometimes new species are discovered, or certain species are downgraded to a subspecies or of a previous species, and then unfortunately some go extinct. So the number is constantly changing, but there's roughly about 5,000 different species worldwide. So that it is a very diverse group of animals. So comparatively, salamanders have around 600 species.
Oh, okay.
So you can see that in terms of amphibians, frogs are far, far more diverse.
And some frogs even live in the desert, which I was surprised to learn.
Yeah, there's even a species of toad, and we'll get into that maybe in a bit, the difference between frogs and toads.
Right.
The short answer is toads are just a kind of frog.
Toads are more warty looking.
They are. So there is a species of toad in, you know, even outback Australia, which is extremely desert-like and hot and arid and dry and wouldn't typically be thought of as an environment where there would be amphibians. And so these toads will stay underground for, you know, sometimes ages until rain, and then they'll come up to the surface for minute periods of time. And then when the rain starts to dry up, they'll go back underground in almost a form of suspended animation. So, you know, brief moments at the surface when conditions are favorable, and then they spend the rest of their time underground. So yeah, it's amazing that animals i.e. amphibians in this case, which are mm-hmm. forever tied to water mm-hmm. and damp environments, can, you know, sometimes even be found in desert-like habitats.
That's interesting. I also found out that wood frogs, which are a Canadian frog, aren't they?
Yeah, I actually saw a wood frog not long ago, and the area I observed it, there hadn't been any records of them in that particular region, and then the next closest one to that, I think it had been close to 20 years the last time one was documented. So it was, that was fantastic to see. But yeah, the wood frogs, I think I know where you're going with this.
Yeah.
They can actually freeze solid. As you mentioned, I'm in Ontario. We get extremes of temperatures in southern Ontario. So hot summers and then cold winters, like well below freezing. And so these wood frogs will actually kind of hunker down in areas of the forest floor and the into the substrate and sometimes under leaf litter, and will freeze solid. And their body produces almost a natural antifreeze that prevents their cells from freezing solid. And that's how they're able to withstand those conditions. And then essentially they thaw out in the springtime.
That's amazing to me. Like, we can't figure out how to do that with humans, but they can do that. So they have
vertebrates too. You know, their internal anatomy really
is similar.
Isn't that much different from ours.
They have permeable skin, which is, so they don't drink at all?
Most of it is absorbed just through their skin. And even to some degrees, they'll breathe through their skin. And salamanders actually take that a step further. When talking about amphibians, there's a whole family of salamanders called lungless salamanders, where their name implies just that. They have no lungs.
Wow.
So all of their gas exchange occurs over the surface of their thin skin. So frogs and salamanders, it really emphasizes how detrimental pollution and chemicals and environmental contamination can be to these animals, where, you know, these are things that are literally breathing and drinking through their thin skin. So any kind of degradation in terms of chemical pollution and things like that can wreak havoc on those types of animals.
They also have on their eyes, they have special eyelids that they can cover their eyes with, but they can still see through to protect their eyes for being underwater.
Yeah, that, and also it helps retain moisture within those areas of their body. So, and that's why typically a lot of amphibians, again, we talked about, you know, the toads in the outback, but generally really have to utilize areas that are so cool and damp and have access to water, because desiccation and dehydration are serious threats to these animals. So that's why they really have to be quite habitat specific.
They also molt, it seems, quite frequently, once a week sometimes.
Yeah, it really depends on the age of the animal and the health of the animal. You know, parasites can, you know, their presence or lack of them. So there's a lot of different factors that can play into them fluffing their skin. Now, snakes and lizards, I think a lot of people are aware they shed their skin. Snakes usually shed it off in one piece. Lizards in flakes. While amphibians, when it comes off, because they don't have scales, they have that permeable soft skin, you don't just find usually a frog or a salamander skin. It's extremely goopy. Now, because I have some captive bred amphibians that I keep for educational purposes to promote conservation, I have seen it myself sometimes, but it's not something that can really be, you know, preserved, so to bring into a school. And they often eat it anyway. As soon as they shed, they often just eat it to recycle those nutrients.
So let's talk about how frogs are born. I used to think that all frogs were hatched out of an egg and became a tadpole, and then gradually grew legs and other things, I guess, and their tail recedes, and they then became what looks like a normal frog. But that's not true, is it?
No, there are some frogs that are born fully formed. Same with salamanders. So most amphibians start off in a tadpole or larval state, and then gradually the rest of the body forms into, they look like miniatures mm-hmm. of the adults. There are some frogs and salamanders that are born sort of already at that point. Like there's a South American toad called the Pipa Pipa, and the babies actually form in depressions on the backs of one of the adult Pipa Pipas and will sort of leave these little holes as not as tadpoles, as fully formed miniatures of the adults. So that general life cycle of the amphibian as a soft jelly-like eggless, or sorry, mm-hmm. shellless egg in a damp environment, hatches out as a tadpole, and then forms into a frog, is what generally happens. But as we mentioned at the beginning, you know, there's thousands and thousands of frog species. So there's usually, you know, whatever generalization there is, there's usually an exception mm-hmm. somewhere in there, just because they are such a diverse group of animals.
So are frogs good parents?
Would generally, you know, compared to mammals, I wouldn't say they're not bad. I wouldn't say that amphibians are bad parents, but in general, they're not as parental as mammals. And the reason that is that a lot of mammals, when they're born, you know, they're dependent on their parents mm-hmm. for food, or and they need milk, and they need sometimes, you know, to be like physically looked after and watched over. But most reptiles and amphibians, when they're born, they already know instinctively everything they know to survive. So they just immediately kind of are born into this world and know where to hide, where to look for food, how to find food or subdue prey or avoid predators. It's already instinctively in them. So they don't kind of require that sort of parental care. I mean, there are all sorts of different, you know, exceptions. There's pythons that, you know, wrap around their eggs to protect mm-hmm. them. There's a species of turtles in Florida that will actually lay their eggs in alligator nests, because alligators, that's another example of, you know, reptiles or amphibians being parental, is alligators actively guard their mm-hmm. nests, the female alligator. So turtles will lay their eggs in those nests to benefit from that sort of the babysitter of the very parental alligator. There are salamanders that guard their eggs in caves, and, you know, and frogs that do similar behaviors. So throughout the world of reptiles and amphibians, there actually are quite a lot of parental behaviors, but generally speaking, they don't do that, because, again, the offspring simply usually doesn't need it. They know exactly what to do when they're born and where to go and how to survive.
Well, and you mentioned the one that has the eggs on their back, and then I know some of them lay them and end up peeing on the eggs to keep them moist, and, you know, so that was kind of a surprise. I sort of thought they would just, like, spawn kind of like, you know, a salmon and then walk away, but it seems like they still have some involvement over making sure that their offspring are born healthy and, you know, have food and that sort of thing. So we don't typically think about frogs in that way.
No, and people seem to have this stigma, you know, these cold-blooded mm-hmm. animals, which, first of all, cold-blooded is an archaic, outdated term. The proper term is just ectothermic, which just means reptiles and amphibians are generally the temperature mm-hmm. of their surroundings. And so if they're too cool, they move into warmer environments or a sunny space to warm up. And if they get too warm, they move into an area like a pond or a shady area to cool down. So they just kind of utilize the environment around them to regulate their body temperature. And, you know, once they're out thermal regulating, their body temperature can be just as warm, if not warmer, than that of a mammal. So their blood, you know, wouldn't be cold. But, you know, there's mm-hmm. that stigma of, like, cold-blooded animals are primitive and right. dim-witted, but they act, you know, they have a lot of really complex behavior. Like, even, like, there's a salamander called the hellbender, and the fathers will actively guard the eggs, mm-hmm. not the mothers, and will fend off other animals that come towards them. Or there's a species of snake that lays their eggs in alligator nests, just like the turtles that are trying to benefit mm-hmm. from that, you know, make sure their babies are safe. So again, all these different reptiles and amphibians have, you know, all sorts of really complex behaviors. There's frogs in South America that will lay their tadpoles in little pools formed in certain flowers, and then the mother, you know, will go, the father frog will stay by the tadpoles and check on them, and when the frogs are hungry, the tadpole will nibble the father frog to indicate he's hungry. The male frog will then go find the female and call to her to indicate he needs her presence. She will come back then and lay an infertile egg right. within that little pool so the tadpole can eat. So you yeah. sort of have a whole family unit there communicating with each other what they need to ensure their survival. So again, that's, again, not something that people would generally
exactly.
think about
yeah.
when you say mm-hmm. cold-blooded animals. But, you know, that, like I said, it's a very outdated and archaic term. And a lot of what is known about these animals is incorrect or sensationalized. They actually do have a lot of really complex behaviors, and that includes parental and maternal
That's
behaviors.
That's very interesting.
As well.
I understand, I think, a lot better now how I don't know, how unique frogs are. And I know that about a third of the world's frogs are facing extinction. And I'm wondering if this is an inevitable decline in frogs similar to the many other species that are going extinct. Or is there something we can do for them to help that?
I think there is things that we can do, because a lot of the problems these animals are facing are human induced. So if we're the problem, we can also be the solution. So a lot of it is, you know, habitat destruction, roadways that are cutting through mm-hmm. those habitats, fragmenting them, causing mass road kills, chemical pollution and degradation of their environments, harvesting for various trades, whether it's the use for dissection or fishing bait or food markets. And those trades also spread diseases around from one population to another, like rhinovirus and chytrid fungus, which are unique to amphibians in a lot of cases and will decimate populations. So when you kind of look at, you know, climate change, the destruction of natural habitat, the fragmentation of habitat via roads and highways, the spreading of diseases and the harvesting of animals, you know, when all these issues are amalgamated, it's accounting for a lot of frogs being lost because of humans. But there are ways to mitigate some of these things. And that's why I think awareness is so important, you know, letting people know not to support the trades that are impacting frog populations in a negative way. There's road closures mm-hmm. in many areas where amphibians cross en masse in the springtime to help reduce the number of individuals being killed. In some areas, they have amphibian crossing brigades where volunteers will assist them across the road in the direction that they're going, protecting natural habitats mm-hmm. and spaces. So, you know, there are a number of different things that can be done, and we have to stop and consider the fact that, you know, frogs have been around for over 100 million years. So they have, you know, gone through several other mass extinctions. So it would be hopeful to think that they could continue to survive if we provide it with them with the conservation and recovery strategies to kind of, you know, give them that helping hand, considering all the threats that we've caused.
Well, and they seem to be biological indicators of the health of an ecosystem, which is something that we should be
oh, absolutely,
very concerned so. With.
Yeah. So if they're having trouble, that should be a big red flag for us. And we should be looking at what's going on with that, the pollution of the waterways and that sort of thing. I have seen the frog crossing signs and the turtle crossing signs and that sort of thing. I've never actually seen people out there with flags stopping traffic, but that's, I'm sure, to come. You know, the fact that dissection in, for instance, in schools, they're still taking frogs, killing them and having kids dissect them. And for the most part, I think that most kids don't want to do that. I know that I didn't want to do that when I was in school, but there was no other option offered. Now there are lots of other options offered. There's computer models, there's actual handheld resin models with all of the different parts. There's different ways of doing something if we want to look at anatomy of a frog. I know that you have, on your website, you had some information about that and actually even, I think, a letter that students could give to their teachers if they felt that they didn't want to participate in that type of a situation.
Yeah, and that just basically outlines, you know, why the trade in frogs for dissection is negative to the frogs in terms of conservation and outline some of those alternatives and why they should be able to access those alternatives for their learning experience so they can still, you know, learn everything that they're required to do, but they don't have to be hurting frogs to do that, for lack of a better way of putting it, in very simple forms. It's just a very simple way to, you know, make kinder choices to help these animals.
And is it chytrid fungus? Is that
chytrid? Yeah,
chytrid fungus. Is that something that we have in Canada, or is that?
There has been cases of chytrid in Ontario and other parts of Canada. It's not as prevalent as it is in some other sites, but it is definitely something to be aware of. And on my website, there's a page about frog diseases, and there's a link to a video on there. So people that like hiking or camping or nature watching or bird watching, it's important to be aware that they might not be interacting with the amphibians directly, but, you know, walking in damp, mucky areas where there could be potentially spores of that fungus, and then going to another site later on could be indirectly spreading the disease. So there's just tips on there about how to, you know, properly disinfect your gear and boots and things. So when you are out in those natural areas and enjoying nature, you're not going to be, you know, inadvertently, you know, spreading these diseases that can certainly hurt our amphibians.
That's good to know. I'm an avid camper, and I've never thought about disinfecting my boots when I left an area to go to another area. So I'm glad that you're mentioning that. You also have suggested that frogs contribute to keeping our wetlands and forests healthy. How so?
Well, frogs, they're just another important component of those habitats. So if we look at it like a puzzle, right, if you start taking pieces out of it, it doesn't, you know, the picture it's forming or the design it's forming, it doesn't work anymore. It's missing. And then the frogs, you could think of it in most simplistic terms is of that the ecological community is like a puzzle, and every little piece has its part to play. And if you start removing pieces, it doesn't function anymore. So without frogs, and, you know, other parts of the wetland start to deteriorate, and then we can lose our wetlands, which is, you know, not good, because wetlands are natural protection, you know, against floods and droughts and in different areas in different ways. So they benefit us, and they benefit a myriad of different species. Like the one wetland I'm currently collecting observations at, there not only are there frogs there, but there's newts and painted turtles and snapping turtles and garter snakes and water snakes and you know, all sorts of other animals too. And so these places host often wetlands have a diverse assemblage of species that occupy them.
And it's the balance that makes, we don't want to throw the balance of that off.
No, absolutely. And you know, those balances are there for a reason, to help keep things, you know, functioning in a way that benefits all those species and then the environment as a whole, which, you know, trickles down to us as well.
Right.
So.
Well, although humans tend to think that they can do the balancing themselves, but I think we've learned now that if we look at that, that we're not very good at balancing nature. We should just let her do it herself. I know that we've mentioned your website a few times. Can you give us the address?
Yes. So it's frogconservation101.com.
Okay.
So it'd be great if people could take a minute to, you know, visit the website or and learn a little bit about what they can do to help out.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time today, Matt. And thank you also for all that you do for all of these animals.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Animal Voices on CFRO 100.5 in Vancouver, Canada. We leave you today with the melodious sounds of a very famous frog, Kermit. Here's Rainbow Connection. Thanks for listening, and please be kind to the animals.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows, and what's on the other side? Rainbows are visions, but only illusions, and rainbows have nothing to hide. So we've been told, and some choose to believe it. I know they're wrong, wait and see. Someday we'll find it, the rainbow connection, the lovers, the dreamers, and me. Who said that every wish would be heard and answered when wished on the morning star? Somebody thought of that, and someone believed it. Look what it's done so far. What's so amazing that keeps us stargazing? And what do we think we might see? Someday we'll find it, the rainbow connection, the lovers, the dreamers, and me. All of us under its spell, we know that it's probably magic. Have you been half asleep, and have you heard voices? I've heard them calling my name. Is this the sweet sound that calls the young sailor? The voice might be one and the same. I've heard it too many times to ignore it. It's something that I'm supposed to.